Good morning, Saraskan.
Not sure. I think Mr. Narasimha is 30-odd, 75, but in the committee does not have to refer this process. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I can say with joy by other people. Those arrival be, can they be duly introduced so that I know if I know invaders in this committee?
I was going to request that the Department of Social Development introduce themselves. We are joined by the Department of Social Development and the National Prosecution Authority, and I think this lends itself to this bill being a clustered one. I'm expecting two other departments to join us, but we weren't sure because we had to reschedule our entire activities. For the rest of them, South African Police Services and the Department of Correctional Services have indicated their apologies. So I'll just hand over to Social Development and National Prosecution Authority.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Masarasen from the Department of Social Development, National. I'm here with my Chief Director who is joining us very soon. She just landed not long ago.
Okay, my name is Nkisi Peng. I'm in the Directorate for Social Crime Prevention, responsible for police and legislation. Thank you.
council elections at the Free State University, where for the third consecutive year, the Free Ram Front won with a clear majority. And maybe, yes, that may be the writing on the wall for the DA and the ANC. That was, but I'm not going to elaborate on that point further. Chairperson, yes, I'm not going to take the matter further because I have discussed it with Mr. Mervyn Hendricks, the pension implications of a member who may want to resign from his party before the end of the term, and then maybe rather than support another party. There is not really big financial implications. It's a matter of if you resign for a week or 2 weeks, just that contribution that particular person will lose. So it's not that substantial, and any person who wants to do that must make that sacrifice. It may have another implication if such a member comes back to act, but it's not that serious. So given that situation, I will not take the matter further, save for saying that we as a party, right from the outset, while it was introduced in the beginning by the DA and supported at that stage by the DP and then supported by the ANC, the floor crossing, we were against it right from the beginning, and we are still against it. I just add this other thing, and I indicated clearly that I did not have the mandate of my party. I discussed it with my party. I had one mandate dated 2 weeks further and see what the financial implications for a member is. And so in that regard, I don't think it's worthwhile to take the matter any further. But thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Dr. Van Heerden. Mr. Leroux and Mr. Mack, you intimidated Dr. Van Heerden. No. You're not supposed to do this to my colleague, please. Honorable Dolly, Honorable Mosaic, Honorable Leroux.
Yes, but I would like to thank the doctor that he is not taking this further, because I was going to say it shows that the FF Plus is a political party with no principles.
Now, Chair, let's just remind the Honourable Doctor this floor crossing thing. This floor crossing thing was never an ANC baby. It was never an ANC baby. You know what ANC did was to give those parties that don't have principles benefit of doubt, because you know what they thought when they argued very strongly that this law should be introduced. They thought members of the African National Congress were cross to their party or to their party. And unfortunately, that did not happen. The opposite happened. Members of those parties crossed to the and they began to cry foul again. Well, as a democratic movement, we had to say, no, that's fine. You are satisfied that you could not achieve anything. So that we are prepared to go. But that's how democratic we are. And I think the President must also remind the Honorable Doctor here that the ANC is not in coalition with the DA. You know, that must be very clear. And we are not likely to be in coalition with I think that should be clarified, Chairperson, because as we talk, it actually insinuating that we are in coalition with them, and we are not. We are not even in alliance with them, and we are not actually preparing to do that. ANC remains a liberation movement, remains a democratic liberation movement, and it will stay that way. We will not abandon our principles. I think that must be very clear. Thank you very much.
It's only in Beaufort West where we are governing together with the DA in the municipality.
Because if we miss passing this bill now, it means the floor crossing will continue even next year in September. Yeah, that takes care of the floor crossing bills. Can I check with colleagues if, because in my opinion, I don't know what you are going to think, because in my opinion, for the two bills, the general laws amendment bill and the constitution 15th amendment bill, on those ones, I think it is desirable for us to pass them in this parliament. For that, I'm saying we have to read the motion of desirability. If you think it is desirable, I want to get a brave member who will move a motion in terms of the Constitution 15th Amendment B. Who is this member is brave enough to get assistance to move that kind of a motion? Honorable what? The Constitution 15th Amendment Bill, the motion of desirability thereof, has moved to Honorable West. Any second?
Second, Mr. Chair.
Seconded by, by Honorable Van der Merwe. Thank you very much. That will be done accordingly. Can we now go to the General Laws Amendment Bill? Let me check who is this member who is brave enough ready to break the ice and move for that motion of desirability. Any mover taker? Honorable Tori?
Mr. Chair, I do move.
Moved by Honorable Tori, any seconder? Seconded by Honorable Museki. That is that. Then we are going to make sure that they will follow all processes for these two bills to be passed in this parliament. Thank you very much, colleagues. Can I, without any waste of time now, hand over to the department to talk to us about the Child Justice Bill. I'm told it is very technical. And how many pages, by the way? Something like 60 something pages.
It's a big one, it's 100 clauses.
My word. Members, so it means that we have to concentrate and really listen very carefully to what I'm going to say. Can I now formally hand over to, I don't know who's going to start, Lawrence, it's yourself who break the ice and then you continue in that order for all those who are going to address the committee. We'll see how far we can go. If you don't finish now, or if we feel we're tired, you can take it further. We'll simply adjourn. We'll continue because we're having this on the program from today until Thursday. Yeah, over to you, Chief.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm not going to be doing much of the talking today. Before I hand over, Chair, as I said, I think we're going to be doing it in two phases, subject to you and your committee's approval. Ms. Kusana and myself will deal with the contents of the bill. And Ms. Sahidna, her team will deal with the implementation issues. I would suggest that we start off with the legislation and try and give an overview of what the bill is about. Chair, this isn't. We spoke about it quite a bit and decide, and in trying to decide how we should approach it.
Secretary of State and the Chair is what it's a term that comes out of the Children's Act, which was passed by Parliament in 2005. A child and youth care centre, I think it'd be easiest to refer in, under the old Child Care Act, used to have places of safety and secure care facilities. These child and youth care centres are the new terminology in terms of the Children's Act for similar institutions where children can be kept. A child justice court, I'd also, and Tanda's going to deal with that in more detail, but a child justice court is nothing more. It's not a court that has been established specifically. It's not a new type of court. It can be a magistrate's court at district or regional court level. It can be a high court. It is simply one of the existing courts that constitutes itself as what we call a child justice court. A preliminary inquiry also features very strongly in the bill. A preliminary inquiry, the definition says, means an inquiry referred to in Chapter 7. A preliminary inquiry is the first appearance of a child in court. It's an informal, and Tanda will tell you more about it, it's an informal inquiry where certain role players get together and try and deal with issues that need to be dealt with at a first court appearance, whether the child must be kept in detention, if the child must be kept in detention, where must the child be detained, is diversion a possibility, but I'll leave that there. Chair, I just wanted to highlight those few definitions because I think it'll make the briefing a whole lot easier, because those are terms that come up a lot in the briefing.
Before you get started, you said an appropriate adult,
Yes, Chair, an appropriate adult.
For the first time.
Yeah. It is a new term in our statute. And an appropriate adult, I think it is also in social development legislation. So I think we borrowed it more or less from there. My colleagues will help me. And it means any member of a child's family, including a sibling who's 16 years or older, or a guardian or caregiver, referred to in Section 1 of the Children's Act. And the purpose in this bill of an appropriate adult is to stand in where a child doesn't have a parent or guardian. The court, our law requires children to be assisted by their parents when they appear in court, and if a child doesn't have a parent or guardian, the intention is, for instance, that the appropriate adult will stand in the place of the parent or guardian. We live in an age where there are more and more household child-headed households, and I think that is one of the situations where an appropriate adult could be used.
Yeah, I will allow Madam to continue. But colleagues, because this is a sick bill, I'll allow you at any time if you don't want to sit and ask questions while the bill is going on. Feel free to call for my attention and ask the question. But I will now allow them to conduct the briefing now. But again, some of them are raising their hands now before the briefing is done. And I will do it.
Thank you, Chair. I think you have said something about the appropriate adult. I just wanted to check. You remember when we are going around doing the oversight, we found that in prisons there are some children, and then when you ask, they said no, the parents said they don't want to see these kids, they can't take care of them. In that case, what is an appropriate adult? Let's say it's a biological parent, but that parent does not want to where do we get an appropriate adult? Can you identify that parent as an appropriate adult? That's
Madam?
Chair, I think one has to look at the phenomena of children in conflict with the law from a variety of aspects. We need to take into account that there is a great deal of dysfunctionality in our families and our communities. And we've had children who, as a result, and I don't want to make light of it, have entered into the criminal justice system because of the socio-economic factors. traumatizing children, and they end up with all of the phenomena around us. One example would be gang-infested areas becoming criminalized, entering into the system, where parents who are currently there are unable to provide the kind of supervision. So preventing in our country is a major challenge, especially when we see children going through the criminal justice system. Unfortunately, the numbers have been increasing. So that is one aspect of it. The reason why, and I think parts of it are debatable, you will see a strong point, especially in the objects of this bill, referring to the kind of parental care and support we need to provide as a society, because it also takes into account that when we manage children through the criminal justice system, we shouldn't just criminalize them as the old system had required, as opposed to looking at what care and support is there. You will also find that there's a lot of reference of this particular act, because if you look historically at our society and the way our criminal justice system has responded to the needs of children, particularly those in need of care, we've processed them through the criminal justice system as an only resort. Ordinarily, the courts, as an example, should be the last resort, but because there are no other options and interventions, they would have been processed through the criminal justice system. If you look at the Children's Act in particular, the one that will come into effect soon, you will see a very strong prevention mechanism and strategy. And that process is going to be costed soon. And you will see that this bill, which discussion is encompassed in the object, is that we've got to look at those prevention and look at the pieces of legislation in conjunction with each other, because we couldn't obviously deal with prevention, etc., in this bill, but we need to look at, recognize all of those dysfunctionalities. So we do have cases where parents come to court and would say, I'm sorry, but I have no control over this child, or I can't do certain things. That is a phenomenon. When we put the issue of appropriate adults in this context, it was looking at children who had no parents, child-headed households, also to a large extent elderly-headed households, because of the phenomenon of HIV and amongst other factors. And if you look at the Children's Act, which is where we brought this term from, there is a provision in the Children's Act, especially when you have to provide a grant to children where they cannot provide for themselves, the appropriate adult would be the person who would come and support them. We also have another phenomenon of children used by adults to commit crime. And you will see we've recognized that in Section 92 of this bill, correct about the section number, in this particular bill, because we're finding that the numbers of children that adults use to commit crime is on the increase. So we distinguish between being careful about using an adult who may be actually the person who's inciting you to commit further crime, and distinguish that from an appropriate adult who would be somebody in your community who is recognized to give you the kind of support where necessary. So there are major differences, and I think as we answer more questions and respond to it, we might come up with more examples. But I think one can't look at it from one angle. We have to recognize that there's so many phenomena which is creating unfortunately an enabling environment for children to just end up in the criminal justice system.
Thanks very much, Sharon. As I said, members will keep on shipping in whenever they want to ask for some second questions. Madam, welcome. Welcome very much. We inform that doing that, but to you as well, let me apologize for starting before you arrive. I apologize. And that's it. Talk to us, though.
Emanates from the report of the South African Law Reform Commission, as the Rat has mentioned. The investigation was requested by the late Minister Dalauma around 1997, shortly after South Africa ratified the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. The convention requires state parties to promote the establishment of laws, procedures, and institutions specifically specifically applicable to children alleged or recognized or accused of having infringed penal law. Further, it was imperative to establish a criminal justice system specifically for children in accordance with the provisions of Section 28 of our Constitution. Section 28 of our Constitution regards every person under the age of 18 years as a child, and it sets out the rights of a child in conflict with the law, which includes, it gives the right not to be detained except as a matter of last resort, in which case, in addition to the rights and freedom a person has in terms of Section 35 of the Constitution, a child may be detained only for the shortest appropriate period, and it also gives the child the right to be kept separately from and detained separately from the persons over the age of 18 and be treated in a manner and kept in conditions that take into account the child's age. Section 28 also provides that every child has the right to have a legal representative. Legal representative assigned to the child and at the state expense if substantial injustice would result. The bill that was introduced in Parliament in 2002 was adopted quite considerably by the Portfolio Committee in 2003. And the main reason for this was taking into account that the changes proposed by the Portfolio Committee to address the concerns relating to the implementation of the bill and the government department's readiness to implement the bill. The Portfolio Committee in 2003 was worried about the lack of the capacity to carry out the legal obligation and to implement the bill as it was introduced. Like, for instance, the ability to have every child assess or to have the children appear at a preliminary inquiry, and whether there was enough diversion service providers and diversion programs required by the bill. But it's 7 years down the line, and the departments have, in the meantime, been continuing to prepare themselves for the implementation of the bill. During the latest round of the deliberations of the Portfolio Committee, It became apparent that the role-playing departments are now ready or are in a better position to implement the bill. The bill that is before the Select Committee now takes into account or recognizes the government's readiness to implement the bill, and the capacity has improved in the government department to implement the bill. Looking at the broad terms in terms of the bill intends to establish a criminal justice system for children in conflict with the law in accordance with the values of our Constitution. The bill also intends to amend the common law regarding the age of criminal capacity and to provide a minimum age of criminal capacity for children. The bill also tries to provide for a mechanism to deal with children who lack criminal capacity outside the formal criminal justice system. It also makes provision for securing attendance of a court and the release or detention and placement of children. The bill also tries to make provision for the assessment of children who have committed crimes and for holding of a preliminary inquiry. The bill also incorporates as a central feature of the Act the possibility of diverting matters involving children away from the formal criminal justice system in appropriate circumstances. It also makes provision for a child justice court to hear all trials of children whose matters are diverted from the formal criminal justice system. It also extends the sentencing options available in respect of children who have been convicted and to entrench the notion of restorative justice into our criminal justice system. This is indicated in the long title of the bill and the preamble. clause 2 and clause 2 sets out the object of the bill as well as the guiding principles of the bill. Now, going through the discussions of the main features of the bill, chapter 2 of the bill covers the application of the bill, the criminal capacity of children under the age of 14 and other matters related to age. Regarding the application of the bill, as a general rule, this is covered by clause 4 of the bill. As a general rule, the bill applies to any person who was under the age of 10 at the time the offence was committed, and to a person who is 10 or who is 10 years or older, but under the age of 18 when the person was arrested or was called upon to appear at a criminal inquiry in terms of a summon or in terms of the written notice, as we will see later. Clause 4 also provides for an exception to the general rule. In terms of the exception, the bill may apply to a person who is alleged to have committed an offence when the person was under the age of 18 and is now 18 years or older, but under the age of 21 when he is arrested or is called upon to appear at a criminal inquiry. Clause 5 of the bill contains a roadmap regarding the main.
I want to talk to us about this 10 years, whatever. Are you saying? Can you unpack that one to us, the 10 years and below 18 and whatever? But I want to check the capacity of a child is capable of committing an offense. That's what I'm telling you exactly. From which age, I would say, a child is capable of committing an offense. And which child is exempted, who, in terms of the law, we might say that particular child, unfortunately, even though he or she committed an offense, but then, talk to us, please, but I want to, before I pass clause 4, I want to understand this.
Okay, the minimum age of criminal capacity is going to be covered by the clause 7 or clause 9 down the line. But what clause 4 provides is for the application of the Act. The Act would apply to a child who is under the age of 10 years. But as we will see from the following clause, a child who is 10 years, who is less than 10 years, does not have criminal capacity. And a child who is 10 years or older, but under the age of 18, the Act would apply and will have criminal capacity. Is regarded as having criminal capacity, but this is dealt in detail in the following clauses.
Yeah, I think clause 4 is all, one could also, there are quite a few what we call roadmap provisions in the bill, and clause 4 I think just sets out right at the beginning, in general terms, who this bill applies to, as Tanda has already said. It applies to children under 10 who have no criminal capacity, but it applies in limited circumstances. And as Tanda has said, when we get to that clause, how we deal with children under 10 who have no criminal capacity, they get dealt with in a special way, but the bill, certain clauses of the bill, does apply to them. So that's what clause 4 is trying to say up front. It does apply to children under 10. In the main, it applies to children who have criminal capacity between 10 and 18. And as an exception, it can also be applied to children who commit offences while under 18, but are 18 years or older, but under the age of 21. So I think what clause 4 is trying to say right up front is to sort of set an introductory provision to say how the law will be applied. And the questions I think that you raised and Tanda said on criminal capacity are dealt with in detail just a bit further on in the book.
Okay, no, it's fine. We'll get there. I'm raising this because of some of the questions members raised when we're dealing with the Sexual Offences Act. You remember there's a big argument about the age of the child. You know, some of the NGOs who came to make presentation, they said that there's contradictions about the ages of child in our laws. Some said we set the standard when a child is
capable of going to or cannot be forced to get permission from parents when, for example, she wants to terminate pregnancy. The fact that the age there is lower to 12, but when you go to something like, what's the thing like, virginity testing, the age is up to about 16. Some were questioning some of these things, but I think you're right, Wilbert. Let's cross the bridge when we arrive at it. Second of the color and
don't. Okay, looks like it's also another roadmap regarding the manner in which a child who is allergic has committed an offense is to be dealt with. If a child who is allergic has committed an offense is below or under the age of 10, the child must be referred to a probation officer and to be dealt with in terms of section or in terms of clause 9. As will be pointed later, because a child under the age of 10 years who commits an offense does not have criminal capacity, such a child is dealt with differently to children who are 10 years or older but under the age of 18. Every child who is 10 years of age or older but under the age of 18 and who is alleged to have committed an offense and who is required to appear in court for a criminal inquiry must be assessed by a probation officer before his or her first appearance at a preliminary inquiry. A preliminary inquiry must be held for every child who is alleged to have committed an offence unless the offence is withdrawn or it's directed by the prosecutor in terms of Chapter 6 as we will discuss later, or the criminal capacity is unlikely to be proved, in which case the child would be dealt with in terms of clause 9. Except criminal inquiry, the matter may be considered for diversion in terms of Chapter 8, and this is dealt with in clause 52. If a matter is not diverted or withdrawn, the matter is then referred to the Child Justice Court for a plea and trial in terms of Chapter 9. And during the trial, diversion may also be considered at the best stage. Now, the bail contains schedule, and the schedule play a certain important role in terms of the bail. It is necessary to indicate the significance of clause 6. This clause sets out the seriousness of three different categories of offenses. Schedule 1 contains the least serious offenses, your offenses such as trespass, common assault, and petty theft. And then Schedule 2 contains offenses which are more serious than Schedule 1 offenses, but not very serious or more serious as offenses in Schedule 3. The offenses in Schedule 2, examples would be serious theft, robbery without aggravating circumstances, housebreaking, and numerous less serious sexual offenses than assault with the intent to do grievous bodily harm. And the Schedule 3 contains the most serious offenses, such as treason, murder, rape, and other sexual offenses, and robbery, which involves car hijacking. It is also important to note that the bail is a criminal procedure for children. It regulates how children who are in conflict with the law must be dealt with. The bail must, however, be read with in conjunction with the Criminal Procedure Act in certain circumstances. Clause 4 also provides that the Criminal Procedure Act applies except where this bill makes specific provision for children or where the bill amends what is contained in the Criminal Procedure Act in case of a child. Clause 4 also provides a useful tool for persons who will be applying or implementing the bill. It refers to Schedule 5 at the end of the bill, which is intended to be an exposition of the interface between this bill and the Criminal Procedure Act. Now, dealing with amending the common law relating to criminal capacity.
Yes, Dr. Fania, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just
how the child justice bill will affect the Criminal Procedure Act. So where there is blank spaces, it means that the Criminal Procedure Act applies, not affected by the child justice bill.
Before you continue to tell us, there is fresh tea outside. I don't think we should break now. I'll allow members to quietly sneak out, grab your cup and come in. Let's continue. Yeah. To the end and talk.
The criminal capacity has always been regulated by our common law. In terms of our common law, a child under the age of 7, this is the position currently. In terms of our common law, a child under the age of 7 has no criminal capacity and cannot be prosecuted for a criminal offense. And a child who is 7 years old or older, but under the age of 14, is regarded as not having criminal capacity until criminal capacity is proved by the state. The bill now amends common law. The bill amends these common law principles. In terms of this bill, the minimum age of criminal capacity is now at 10. A child who commits an offense while under the age of 10 does not have criminal capacity and must be referred to a probation officer to be dealt with in terms of clause 9, which will be dealt with. When a child who is alleged to have committed an offense is 10 years of age, or older, but under the age of 14 years, the child is presumed to lack criminal capacity unless the state proves beyond reasonable doubt that the child has the required criminal capacity. Okay. In terms of the current law, a child under the age of 7 does not have criminal capacity and cannot be prosecuted. Now, what the bill says now is that it increases that age to 10 years. So a child who's under the age of 10 years has no criminal capacity and can never be prosecuted for a criminal offense. But a child who is 10 years but under the age of 14 is also presumed, is taken not to have criminal capacity, but the state may prove that that child actually does have criminal capacity, in which case the child will be regarded as having criminal capacity and will be prosecuted. If the state fails to prove that the child who is between 10 and 14 has criminal capacity, the child is then regarded as not having criminal capacity and will not be prosecuted, will be dealt with as a child who is under the age of 10 years, who doesn't have criminal capacity. I don't know.
I didn't know. Why complicate this thing? Why complicate this thing? If you say a child below 10 doesn't have criminal capacity, that's it. Anything above that, then laws, our court or a lot of the country will determine as well as a child. But to even go there, I don't know. Please convince my patient me to accept what you're saying now, because I'm not that much. I want the social development to come in as well to address us about this. I'm not. I'm not the only one who's skeptical about this. But, I mean, that the child 10 and below does not have criminal capacity, but a child who is 10 but below 14. Yeah, complicated this thing. I don't know. Young, please talk to me, Sister Lord. Talk to me. And when Lawrence, you know, if you come in and share in, and all of you, please persuade me to accept this, because I might propose an amendment before we go to the formal
Can I just give you a bit of background? I think we know that that's the position at the moment, that the age, the current age for criminal capacity is 7 and then the 10 you still keep the existing intermediate stage where a child, where the state must prove that a child has criminal capacity between 10 and 14. So I just thought I'd add that to them. I might want to say something as well.
Another little come last. Sharon, continue.
I was just going to say, if you just look at also part of the reasons why we kept the rebuttable and irrebuttable presumption, is that once you've reached the age of 10, which was the compromise position here, you do get to different levels of maturity of children where they're able to comprehend whether whatever activity they've undertaken is acceptable or not acceptable. And that is why we've got that period between 10 and 14, which is subject to review after 5 years. But what is also very important to take account of is that we do have, unfortunately, children under, as the current position is, children under the age of 12 who are still committing offences. You will see that our offences in terms of children increases from the age of 14 upwards. So as much as you don't have, the numbers start increasing from 12 years, and from 14 to 17 is where we have the highest number of children committing offences. But we also, as a country, we've had a lot of submissions, and with the UN standards, the current minimum international age is 12, and the compromise position that was reached in this bill would be 10, subject to review as we proceed. Because also of the onerous aspects on assessment and the capacity of the state to manage the entire assessment process, what this bill has brought to the fore is that therapeutic element to the criminal justice system, whereas if you're under the age of 10, you'll not be processed through the criminal justice system per se. You'll be processed through the social aspect of the criminal justice system, where you would have then gone through the entire assessment process. And you will see under Section 9, it then takes you to different components of what could be done with you so that you don't then enter the formal criminal justice system. Because we found that as soon as we take you into, as a state, you end up following the criminal justice business process. So you would make it in detention whilst you are child in need of care, and then you're subject to a lot of criminal elements that may be in detention, and then you end up becoming a recidivist, an offender, and being criminalized. And the intention is all those under 10 then are not then processed through that system that goes to a different system. That's just some of the practicalities that were taken into consideration as to why this has happened. We also found with the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child that South Africa presented its report, which is recommended position that we must raise the minimum age of criminal capacity, because ours was very low, being at 7.
Thank you, Chair. I think just to add. Okay, sorry, Chair. I'm calling Mike from Social Development. Just to add on what my colleagues have said, I think these presumption clauses also provide us with an opportunity to accommodate those children who have got developmental stage problems, like your children with mental disabilities. And sometimes you can find a child who's 13 but behave or develop like a 5-year or a 7-year old.
For instance, a child might go into a shop down where is the cutoff for a child to have the capacity to commit murder and to commit a simple offense as just stealing or taking something. Because in a child's mind, it's not stealing, it might be just taking something. And he doesn't think criminally. And when is there the capacity for more serious crimes? I don't see children planning something. They're not in that stage of planning to steal or plan to rob or something. So the thing of how do you accommodate and how do you determine then the capacity, that is, I think, where we're going to have problems in court. And who will determine that capacity and how will it determine? Will the social services come in and evaluate a child before saying, but this child has the capacity? Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, that will also depend on the judicial officer, because if you find one judicial officer arrive at a different conclusion than the one, you know. Yeah, question put?
There is a clause that deals specifically with the establishment of the criminal capacity. The extent of the clause to the judgment later is the presiding officer where the criminal capacity is an issue may call upon a suitable qualified person, which is normally would be a medical practitioner. But the issue that is raised by the honourable member, I think, should be covered by assessment. During the assessment, the probation officer should be able to identify the motive of the child for committing the offences. And the deal of deals with those issues in terms of the child in need of care. The probation officer will be able to identify that and know how to deal or direct the presiding officer on how to deal with the child.
The probation officer, I refer to the ones like the ones who had allowed Mark Crosley to be released. Those are the people who are relying on.
No, he took a role.
Hey. Ah, that's it. Here we come. Okay, that was a commercial break. Yeah, I can respond to this question directly.
Just to add on to what Tanda said, you know, every child that's alleged to have committed an offence, if that child is going to go to court, must be assessed by a probation officer. But in addition to that, and that's what Tanda said in Clause 11, and Clause 11 says that the state must prove beyond reasonable doubt the capacity of a child who is 10 years or older but under the age of 14 to appreciate the difference between right and wrong at the time of the commission of an alleged offence and to act in accordance with that appreciation. And then it goes on to say that in making a decision regarding criminal capacity, the inquiry magistrate must consider the assessment report of the probation officer and all evidence placed before the court, which evidence may include a report of an evaluation referred to in subsection 3. So in addition to the assessment by the probation officer, if criminal capacity of the child between 10 and 14 is at stake, the court may order an evaluation of the criminal capacity of the child by a suitably qualified person, which must include an assessment of the cognitive, moral, emotional, psychological, and social development of the child. So it is really quite an intense investigation into the child. That's another fact. That's in addition to the original assessment that is done by a probation officer. And criminal capacity, as I've already indicated, must be proved beyond reasonable doubt. If there's still any doubt, then the accused person, the child in this case, must get the benefit of that doubt.
Yes, Kevin?
I just add one more point. I think taking into account that our criminal justice system has never been very child-friendly in a sense. We've also included, if you look at the regulation section 97, that there would be the kind of social child development. So these kinds of issues, which and the genetic principles of both brings to the fore, is that you then distinguish those children that are in need of care or may have entered the criminal justice system as a result of socioeconomic difficulty from those, and distinguish those that you might now have become quite criminalized. But even then, there are attempts with the different personnel in the different departments to have specialized training, not just in how you manage a child in the justice perspective, but also looks at child development. And that's specific, and that must be included in all of the training programs. So it will be that genetic social context, but also child development, to identify that. So we then treat children with in a more humane manner, as opposed to just processing them through the courts. And whilst we have started with those processes, they were never intended in law. It was really existent in our interim protocols, subject to the passing of a particular piece of legislation. So that would take into account more so these kinds of principles when assessing a child.
Yes, Doc.
I think that Section 41, Chapter 6, is an excellent section, and I think it answers a lot of questions in connection with the autistic children, particularly Chapter 6, the responsibility of the prosecutor. And really, I think that that section provides for a lot of questions that may arise.
By the way, the probation of the probation officer from which department are they coming from? Social development.
Oh.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Just a quick distinction between in defense of social development, the parole officer and the probation officer, in line with your commercial break earlier. It's a big distinction, but yes, you're correct, Honorable Member, about 41. But remember what this bill does in terms of the business process as you come through the system is, as soon as you come in, you must be assessed by a probation officer, someone who is skilled in child development and assessing your needs. And if you look at Chapter 9, that covers a lot of the principles in how you would be assessed, what would be taken, what would take into account, especially for children under 10. And then the assessment process deals with it. When you get to the prosecutor, you've already gone into second stage of the criminal justice system. The first people to catch you, if you need that support, would be social development. Second phase would be prosecutor. So if you've fallen through there, and you still need to account for your offense, you would then be diverted by the prosecutor, which deals with the Chapter 6. And then if you've fallen through that again, you would still be able to be caught by the trial, the justice court, where they would also have reference to whatever has come up in your initial assessment. So the attempts to catch you throughout, are there?
That's an issue that I think Shireen mentioned it. There's two clauses in the bill, clause 50 and I think again clause 64, which allows a preliminary inquiry or a child justice court to refer a child that's in need of care or to refer a child that steals food or steals for to get warm. And let me just use the word, if it appears to the inquiry magistrate that the child is alleged to have committed a minor offence or offences aimed at meeting the child's basic need for warmth and need for food and warmth, the inquiry magistrate may stop the proceedings and order that the child be brought before children's court to be dealt with in terms of the Children's Act, where you have a look at the needs of the child and find out whether the child is in need of care and protection.
Yeah, I think it's clear. Let them continue to handle this.
Okay, this has already been mentioned, but the bill also makes provision for the review of the minimum age of criminal capacity as set out in the bill, and the review will be after 5 years from the commencement of the bill. Children under the age of 10 years may not be arrested, but must be assessed and then referred to certain programs
designed specifically for them, for instance, counseling or therapy. None of these proceedings or actions, however, imply that the child under the age of 10 years is criminally liable for the incident, and that led up to the proceedings. Chapter 2 deals with age-related matters. Because children under the age of 14 may not have criminal capacity, the bill adds on the side of the question and requires police officials to deal with children who appear to be 14 years as if they are either under 10 or under 14 until the age of the child has been estimated by the probation officer or the medical practitioner as established by a court of law. It is a preliminary inquiry or the child justice court. And this is dealt with in clause 12 of the bill. An entire part of chapter 2 has been set aside regulating how the child's age must be estimated by a probation officer during the assessment of the child before the criminal inquiry, or how the child must be determined by a preliminary inquiry of the child justice court. And this is dealt with in clauses 13, 14, and 15 of the bill. Clause 15 deals with the situation where a mistake has been made regarding the age of the child. If a child has been treated as a child and is found that the child is not actually a child in terms of the bill, the proceedings must be continued under the Criminal Procedure Act if the child is found to be an adult. If the person has been treated as an adult and is found that the person is actually a child and the bill applies, then the proceedings must be dealt with or continued in terms of this bill. If any decision taken in the proceedings before the discovery of the error regarding the age has caused prejudice to the child, the matter may be referred to the High Court for a review. The High Court can, when reviewing the matter, set the proceeding aside and undo any prejudice that may have been caused on the child or on the person in question. Then chapter three deals with the methods.
Maybe for the first one of them. One of the tell you. And Dr. Paniate, in went to Virginia in one prison day. So at this point, when he was arrested, he was 12. Went there as a community, and it was after about 5 years or so. We thought that he was still in awaiting the training. Now, I suspect he was trying to address those kind of scenarios where when that poor child was arrested, he or she was in that age. But because of the poor system, not justice system, five years down the line, the person is still awaiting trial detaining. And then, how do you address those kind of scenarios? I saw that someone here, and even at the 7 months in prison, when they saw some young children there, but let me say that some of them commit serious crimes. Young as they are, 12-year-old, you know, where was it? Down there at Polmo prison. But this young man, the boy was about 11 or so. And when you look at him, he looked about 8, but the kind of offenses committed in scary. Even in Babatel, Mam Floyd, remember, they showed us there were two boys there who they said there. Now, if it was because of the system that could not fast track, they are clearly as important as ever because of what you know, let's not say it now. And the fact that this poor kid is now, it's about 15, 16, 17, 18 or so. But when you are arrested, you're still in that age where you're not sure as to whether the capacity of this person to commit a crime, says Courtney, your probation officer, as well, they were not active enough and proactive enough against after this water. In that kind of scenario, well, how do you end? I'm addressing on this clause 15, just I talked to Mr. Tanner. I know if you can respond to this. To make me understand how to address that kind of scenario.
Chair, if I may, there are several components to that. One phenomena, and again, it's not, must not be seen as a defensive response that we have, is when portfolio committees, etc., go and visit some of our facilities, we do get children telling us of a specific age because they now have some attention. And if that has to be taken into account, on each of the occasions that a child who would have given a particular age and usually would say, I'm there for, in fact, we had when this portfolio committee on social development visited some of the, when they did their own oversight, visited the facility in Johannesburg, we were told of a person who was under 18 and who had been in there for 5 years. We immediately, when we got the detail, investigated and found that this person was not under 18, was over 18, but happened to look younger and had been in for a multitude of offences. That's the first part. The same time, we do have challenges in the system where somebody would have been in detention for a long period of time. We have, as you will see when we discuss some of the implementation, committee at the national level, which is called the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice. This committee has been in operation for 10 years at the national level. The provincial level has been in operation for about a year and a half. And what that committee was set up to do was fast track the numbers of children in detention. If you recall, prior to 94, we had so many numbers of children in detention. In 1995, after the government had come into effect, they had then put up this committee so we get the numbers of children out. As a result of that committee's inception, you would see we have reduced the number of awaiting trial children from 2002, just looking at that set of statistics, by 50%. We've reduced it even further with us now putting more systems in place where we have a time policy. And within, we would have no child in detention at the moment, even for the last year, where they would have been in detention for more than a period of a year. If they are in, within a day normally, within a few hours, if you brought it to our attention, the system is such that we would track where that child is and Legal Aid Board would respond almost immediately. And we've seen that if you look at when we were in previous committees, where we were told of certain instances, we were able to give an answer before we actually left that committee to say what that child would have been in for. And usually, as you said, Chair, it would have been a multitude of many offences, or we were unable to at the time because the prosecution would have had evidence which says it's not safe to let this child out because of a multitude of phenomena. So at this point in time, we've got a 3 month, 6 months, 1 year cycle, depending on whether you're in the district court, the regional court, etc. And if we do find those types of cases currently, and which is entrenched in this bill, we would then respond almost immediately. So it does cater for that type of scenario. But again, there will always be gaps in such a big system. And when we have specific details, we can then respond almost immediately.
To respond to your question, you raised the question whether Clause 16 would deal with the situation that we've been sketching, and I think the application of Clause 16 for what you've been talking about is limited. I think the redress is going to come in what Shireen's talking about, the Intersectoral Committee, that's where to try and address those mistakes. But Clause 16 is more there to how to continue with the case if you discover that there has been an error as to age.
So we're now looking at Chapter 3. Chapter 3 provides for methods of securing the attendance of a child at court or the preliminary inquiry. The bill provides three methods for securing the attendance.
No, there are very many.
after the occurrences of the management prevent a person from prosecution. Example of that is what you say is that it will be proved beyond reasonable doubt. The state must prove beyond reasonable doubt. I'm trying to think where I am. I come from the rural area where urban financial is very, very difficult. And many people out there in those areas would have been victimized. And when you say to them, look, you are going to, you are playing the church and the state. But the state must be able, and you must help the state to prove that. So remain vague to them, and I really want to be helped, because this is very important for them. That's one thing that I would want to talk to about that conception, that is the way it comes. In your own, what will be improved beyond the reasonable doubt? That is very important. The other important aspect that you're raising, which is also very interesting, and that it will help all of us, those of us who are not lawyers, who are not lawyers, is what you talk about community interest. Trying to figure out, and this, in the context of what we're discussing now, what will really I'm raising this chapter because, you know, this is sometimes it's subject to abuse. It's subject to abuse. You were just finding something about the recent development. The mark cross-discussing. Right. Here we're talking about children. But in community interest, what are we really saying? What in your home, where are you sitting? And that you. That for me, as a layperson, what will be a community interest really when we raise that issue? Think about it.
Maybe before you respond, let me recognize Kuma Munyanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. If my memory serves me well, you remember we went to Benin. Then when we were there, we were tasked to go and visit a youth center. In that youth center, we came up to meet a boy of 10 years. He was arrested of a murder. And he was in that youth center. And the age, 10. And to be in that youth center, he was with other youth who have done twice or thrice murder. And how do you deal with that one? Because this child, he was 10 years when we were there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Oh, yeah, I read that somewhere up there. And the question was, why, or how do you mix a 10-year-old with the boys of 18 who committed those heinous offenses? So someone saying, this the poor kid, you're now training him to murder whatever he was arrested of committing. Yeah, question, so put any one of you, first call, you want to start first?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I want to deal with the one of 10 years. I assume the youth center is for social development because sometimes correctional services also has got a youth center. So in that context, I would indicate that because currently the age of criminal capacity is 7, that child, if it's 10 years, it means qualifies to be at a secure care facility or youth center if it's for social development. And the inner secure care facilities, they are not mixed in terms of the programs they go through, because their programs are categorized in terms of their age-relatedness. If that was done and that was experienced by the committee, it's really wrong. It's something that we need to attend to as DSD. They're not supposed to be mixed in terms of the rooms they are allocated and the type of programs they go through.
Yeah, I remember the name of that center. It's a Eureka. Eureka Youth Center. Can you continue with that response? Yes, sorry.
Just to add on what Connie said, what the board is now doing, of course, would be changing the age of criminal capacity. But I'm not too sure at what stage was this 10-year-old. It might have been after conviction, or it might have been awaiting trial. The bill prohibits, or intends to prohibit at this stage, the detention of children under the age of 14 in prisons. And I think that just also relates to what you said, Chair, that, you know, they get mixed up with adults or 18-year-olds in prisons, and they learn their trade. The bill is going to hopefully put an end to that, because children under 14 years old won't be mixing with the older criminals in prisons and elsewhere. And as Connie's already said, they do keep are kept separately.
With one question,
Chair,
I on the issue of beyond reasonable doubt, and my colleague from the NPA was to go through the stages of how do you prove beyond reasonable doubt.
Thanks, Chair. When it comes to approve beyond reasonable doubt, it's an S of the S, element of the offense. Then it means that the prosecution must then be able to prove that the accused has been committed on the offense, the only element of the offense. Therefore, it's up to the prosecution to prove that if the offense needs detention, to prove that it is the time consent, had detention, actually committed that particular offense. Not the fact that he claims he committed that thing. So where is the element of the offense are not all proved to the satisfaction of the court, then it cannot be said that the matter is proven beyond the court. However, if all the elements are proven to the satisfaction of the court, then it can only then be said that the prosecution has met beyond the court. And if there is a doubt, then that's a comment. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know whether Mr. Maseki's question about community interest has been addressed.
No, I thought just to end with it, because that's the question that they did. Get the thing before you respond to it. Community interest. Who wants to attempt to respond?
I'll try, and my colleagues are helping me very nicely. Appreciate that. And I hope I'm on the right track, Mr. Maseki. If you have a look at the objects of the bill in clause 2, just as a way of example, I've lost the place. One of the objects is to promote the spirit of Ubuntu in the child justice system through reinforcing children's respect for human rights and the fundamental freedoms of others by holding children accountable for their actions and safeguarding the interests of the victims and the community. I think that sort of concept also comes out in the guiding principles in clause 3, and then you'll see as we get on in the bill, there are specific clauses dealing with community interest. If you go to sentencing and if you go to detention, and I'm just trying to find specific clauses, but we will get to those, whether the child must be kept in detention and what sort of detention must the child be kept in. Is it high care, is it prison,
Alan has touched on it to a large extent. For the first time in our legislation, the whole concept of restorative justice is legislated for should this law go ahead. And I think when you look at just the preamble, you would see that it says it expands and entrenches the principles of restorative justice. It also recognizes the current realities of crime and the need to be proactive in crime prevention by placing increased emphasis on effective rehabilitation and reintegration. It also looks at balancing the interests of children, those of society, with due regard to the rights of victims. And I think we've brought in the principles, particularly from the perspective of having restorative justice in our history. On our continent, we have practiced this for many years. It has just never been legislated for. It is also always considered to be a bit of an alternative to the current system. What this bill has done is brought that to the fore, that we can then balance looking at rehabilitation, looking at accountability and the needs of a particular community insofar as what is correct, as long as it's compatible with the constitutional framework. So it's brought all of our principles, I think a lot of it, from our indigenous systems of resolving disputes and looking at it from a dispute mechanism outside of the litigious adversarial system. And that is where I think the second point also comes through, in that, and I think one has to recognize we've been a country where the legal literacy is very low, let alone our literacy levels. And we, whether we live in a rural area, it doesn't really matter. Even those of us in the urban area, unless you've been trained and proficient in law, some of these are quite technical, and we've not done enough awareness and information countrywide to get us familiar with those principles. So I think that is going to be something, and if you would, when we get to, but it seems like we're almost getting into what we would have presented in terms of implementation, we will, once the bill's passed, come up with a very strong mechanism for raising awareness, coming up with a guide on how to understand this particular act, not just for adults, but also for children to understand, because they are going to be processed through the system. So some of the key technical points would have been simplified, and we also intend to translate them into our official languages so that the principles are understood and all of us then know how to interact with the law. Just goes to the just whole aspect of access to justice, that in order to know your, protect your right, you need to know what your right is. And that's something historically we haven't really, we've had a challenge with, and part of our access to justice campaign, as it were, in terms of making all laws very simple, user-friendly, and efficient in a way, not just for adults, but also for children to comprehend.
Any more response? Ramusek, in the interest of the public.
Children pulling the silence.
actually, this is a perfect example. This question should be answered. And I'm happy that you said awareness and other things were discussed. I think that's right.
Yeah, at some point, the Department of Justice and Social Development, they might respond to this question. What made our case to court in crime? Because you go to this prison, or even this police, what do you call them, by the way? Police cell. Even many kids who had committed crime, the question is, what made them to commit crime? Yes, you know, violent crime, that's what I want to do. Violent crime, why? As a society, we have to respond to this question, as I said. What caused them to do some of these things? Some of them, when you look at them, you say to yourself, but this kid looks so young, but the kind of offense they are committing. At some point, please, today, I wanted to respond to this question. In your own research and investigation, as you're dealing with the, some of these cases on dailiness. But what are the reasons? Because as a politician, I'll come with my own reasons that might not be scientific, but I'll have the reasons as to why they're happening. But because you are hands on this thing, you might come with a better explanation. So sometimes to the left of them.
Provide three methods for securing attendance of a child at a preliminary inquiry. That is the written notice, summons, and arrest. The written notice is the least intrusive method, and arrest is the most intrusive. A written notice may only be issued in respect of a Schedule 1 offense. That is where a child has committed a Schedule 1 offense. And the written notice is the same as the written notice referred to in the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 56 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which a police official can issue to a child at the scene of the crime. The written notice must set out the offense that the child is alleged to have committed, the date and the time when and the place where the child must appear at a preliminary inquiry. It must be handed to the child and his or her parents where possible, and both must acknowledge receipt by way of signature or imani. If the parents are not available, a police official must issue or hand the written notice to the child and to the parents as soon as the circumstances permit. The next method of getting a child to a criminal inquiry is by means of summons, which is dealt with in Clause 19 of the Bill. The bill also uses Section 64 of the Criminal Procedure Act regarding the issuing of a summons. A summons is usually issued by a prosecutor and can be issued in respect of any offense. The bill envisages this method being used where it is not necessary to arrest a child. Like in the case of a written notice, the summons must specify the crime that is alleged to have committed by the child and the date, time, and place where the criminal the child must attend a criminal inquiry. It must be set on the accused person and his or her parents by the police officials. Again, the child and the parents must acknowledge or receipt of the summons by means of a signature or a mark. And then the last method for securing the attendance is the arrest. A police official may not arrest a child who is alleged to have committed an offense reflected in Schedule 1 unless there are compelling reasons, and the compelling reasons are dealt with in the bill and are dealt with in terms of the regulation. Where a police official issues a written notice to a child or sends someone to a child to arrest a child, the official must notify the probation officer for the purposes of conducting an assessment before the child appears at a preliminary inquiry. And then looking at chapter...
Are we having someone from certain security or some sort?
are not here.
Unfortunately, Chair, remember we changed the schedule of the house, so they were committed already and couldn't come out of their commitment today.
The question is that was directed to them. I was not going to respond to
them. May I suggest that if we could park them, and maybe because we have got three rounds, I think, before we come back, if we could do it that way. And between ourselves, we'll attempt to answer, even though we're not accountable in terms of the ninth function, if that is acceptable for the committee.
Yeah, I feel that the two clauses that the Christian Lazarus just took us through, clauses 18 and 19 and clause 20, I think we'll need the judges for some of the things that we're seeing are not in line with what appears here. So I agree with you, maybe we can flag whatever question for now. Yeah.
Maybe before we continue, Chair, I want to find out about the probation officer. Where does he or she come in? I mean, who calls the probation officer if a child has been arrested?
Yeah, the same culprit we're talking about now. I'm not here. One of these arrests.
My police, South African police.
Okay, let's continue. Yeah, colleagues, can we just make a note, any questions to start with, we'll ask them when they're here, because they will be expected to come and talk to us as well. They are so involved in this deal. They are, yeah. Continue to tell us.
Yeah, perhaps just to answer that question, in terms of the bill, the police official after arrest or after serving someone or a written notice must immediately, in terms of the bill, within 24 hours, inform the probation officer of the arrest or the serving of the written notice.
How is it available at this probation officer? Sometimes in the M code. How is it available at this?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We do have a list that is distributed to all police stations with telephone numbers. We have probation officers and assistant probation officers, so that the police, after arrest, they need to inform our probation officers to come and do assessment. But we do have some challenges. It doesn't always happen like that, although we also have an interim protocol that we need to follow. But sometimes it becomes difficult to find children going through the system without being assessed. And as social development, you won't know if a child has been arrested unless someone informs that there is a child that has been arrested and needs to be assessed before he or she goes to court.
I may also add to what they already said. As the linter to the system authority, it becomes then cumbersome to enroll a matter, not knowing exactly whether it's a child is a child in conflict with the law or a child in need of care. When we do encounter cases without assessment support from the probation officer, we will also make it a point that conduct them and we will refer out those cases to them to conduct assessment. So they get involved in the very easily. Yeah, I'm sorry. So I'm saying these probation officers, in all our police stations, are they there? I mean, their names are there, so that the waiting. Let's say if I walk in any police station and ask them, who are the probation officers, can they call them to come immediately when I arrive there?
Thank you, Chair. What the police stations have got is a list, but probation officers are, some of them will place them in courts to do assessments. Some of them are in police stations, and we call that office an RAR, reception, assessment, and reference center. We only station them at police station and court when we do have office accommodation. But otherwise, we accommodate them in our offices. So the traveling distance also, if a police station is very far from our offices, it's a challenge because they need to call them and they need to drive. So we appreciate that if a police station can offer them an office, then we make sure that we accommodate our probation officers there. So most of the courts, they do have probation services in their probation officers in their premises because they made provision of office accommodation, but we still need more.
We'll come to that. We'll come to that. Hey,
I think it seems really the concern being raised that some of the things that are in the bill are all well and good, but these are not happening in practice, and I think that's the sense that I'm getting. I can just point out for what it's worth, right, at the aspect of the bill, the responsibilities or the regulations, directives by the NDDP that must be issued, the national instructions that must be issued by TAPS, and trying to deal with all these details, and that functionally should be carrying out to give effect to this legislation. And that's clause 97, and I just want to point out 97.9, the directive and national instructions provided for in this section must ensure that adequate steps are taken against any functionary who fails to comply with any duty imposed on him or her in terms of this act. I thought I just mentioned, because I'm getting a sense where there is a concern that what the bill is trying to do is trying to, what it's putting down as duties and responsibilities, is also trying to, as far as legislation can go with that sort of thing, trying to ensure that these responsibilities are carried out. But legislation can really only go so far.
Yes, I think to add to that, what Lauren just said, is that a lot of what, and that was what, this is what was most phenomenal about this bill. I think it reflected, from my mind, individually as a lawyer, in the way we draft bills, in that when this bill was being drafted, we sat through the process, not just with the different departments, but also with a lot of intervention from civil society organizations raising some of the challenges of the current system. And you will see throughout the bill, there was a lot of deliberation on what can and can't be realistic in the bill. So if you look at even the objective, the preamble, you will see it acknowledges that there are capacity, resource, and other constraints, and that we require a pragmatic and incremental strategy to implement the new criminal justice system. Coupled with that is the establishment of the intersectoral committee at the level of the Directors General. Even though we have currently the intersectoral committee, which is chaired by us as chief directors, this committee must now also report to the Directors General to look at policy. So over and above what Lawrence was saying in terms of the directives, we have to then on an annual basis, which is phenomenal about this bill because it's put a monitoring and evaluation system in which none of our other bills have to this extent. If you just look at recent legislation that has come through, where we have to then respond, and if you look at the sections under 96, the very points that have been raised as to the integrated system to tell us arrest, how long the children have been there, preliminary inquiries, diversion is actually listed right down from 96B onwards. And then we have to respond on an annual basis, Minister has to present and to Parliament what has happened. So even though I think we will have many challenges, the fact that this provision sets for us a baseline so that annually we can measure progress. Thus far we haven't just started putting in information management systems. If you recall, most of our systems are manual. Pulling together the kind of analysis of data has not always been as accurate as it ought to be. But this bill under 96 also then says we need to establish an integrated information management system. So the question you asked earlier about research, what are the causes, having this integrated entrenched in law and for us to then respond is going to ensure that we have as accurate as possible the kind of statistics so we can give you better analysis and trends, and then track and then measure our progress, which is in line with, you know, the whole aspect of rights-based and ensuring that we've got indicators to measure ourselves by. So yes, there will be challenges, but I think the incremental approach will show us over a period of time how many children are moving through the system and where they are. When we get to some of the implementation aspects, we'll just show you some of the changes that have already commenced as a result of this putting information management system. And also I think we'll go in a little bit later to how we've changed the list for social development services at provincial level as well.
Let's continue. Oh, before that, Honorable Nero.
Okay, so thank you very much. I was listening carefully to what Lawrence said, and he's quite right. I think the capacity problem is worrying me. For instance, I think this is an excellent bill, and the work that was done is done extremely well. But in those deliberations, did they ever discuss whether it is possible for us to implement? And was that discussed in depth? Thank you.
I think Shireen should be answering this, but it was just interesting to answer briefly as it was discussed in great depth.
40 hours of deliberation. Is it 40? 40 hours with government departments, both in close session with the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development, with all of the government departments present, challenging our statistics, looking at what is practical and what is not. And I think there was recognition, if you look at the report that was presented to Parliament, the National Parliament at the time, you will see in the summary a recognition of some of the challenges, because I think that was commonly noted, that we're not a first, I don't want to use that term, for obvious reasons, for how one gives definitions to certain processes, but as an example, we're not Sweden, we don't have their resources. We are South Africa with a strong system, but also great need and acknowledging socioeconomic issues. And that is why there is a provision in the preamble that acknowledges we will implement progressively. So there was a lot of deliberation on capacity, and we gave an analysis of the trends as opposed to accurate statistics. We used that analysis from the experience of all of the officials, and this was vetted by a lot of the civil society monitoring structures at the time. So I'm not sure if 40 hours was enough, but it really caused, you can imagine, it was extremely hectic, to use the term, in both our closed and open sessions.
Being 14 or 40, I was 4-0. 4-0. Oh, that was too much, eh? Oh, okay. Now, I think we can continue. We can allow Sister Nazareth to continue. Welcome, Baba Mzizi. We're busy with child justice. Just taking us through the process. We can experience that you'll be able to catch us on the way. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay, we are now looking at chapter 4, deals with the release, detention and placement of the child prior to sentence. This chapter is divided into three parts. The first part deals with the question of either the release or keeping the child in detention. The second part deals with where the child is placed if the child is detained. Each part of the chapter is introduced by the way of the roadmap. The third part is the factors to be taken into account by a presiding officer regarding further detention of a child and their placement in detention. It also deals with the condition of detention at court, which must be complied with. For example, no child may be put into leg irons or handcuffs, and handcuffs may be used in exceptional circumstances. Children must be kept separately from adults and boys, separate from girls, and children must be transported separately from adults unless this is not possible. leave and detention. Clause 21 sets out a roadmap. The subsection 1 is the general rule, namely that the police official or a court should, where possible, consider the release of a child where there has been an arrest. Subsection 2 deals with the situation before the child appears in court. That is where a child can be released by a police official or by a prosecutor. Subsection 3 deals with the situation where a child appears at a first appearance in court and sets out the choices of the court regarding the release of a child. The roadmap boils down to the following. Where a child has been arrested, a police official can release a child in respect of a child of an offense into the care of a parent or an appropriate adult prior to the child appearing in a preliminary inquiry. When releasing a child, the police official must give the child and the parent a written notice to appear at a preliminary inquiry. And then where a child has not been released by a police official, a prosecutor may authorize the release of a child who is accused of committing a Schedule 1 or a Schedule 2 offense, and the release may be on bail. A presiding officer at a preliminary inquiry thereafter can release a child in respect of any offense, Schedule 1, 2, or 3, into the care of a parent or an appropriate adult, or on the child's own cognizance if the child is accused or alleged to have committed a Schedule 1 or 2 offense, and if it is in the interest of justice to release the child. The last option to a presiding officer is to release the child on bail if the child is not otherwise released. If the child is accused of committing an offense listed in Schedule 3. In terms of Section 22, Clause 22, a child may be released on written notice into the care of a parent or an appropriate adult before the child's first appearance, unless a parent cannot be located or the child may be a danger to himself or to any other person. Where the child is not released, the investigating police officers must report this in writing to the preliminary inquiry, providing reasons why the child was not released. When releasing a child, the police officers must hand to the child a written notice as in terms of clause 18. Clause 24 deals with the release at a preliminary inquiry, that is during the first appearance or after the first appearance, and sets out certain factors that should be taken into account by a presiding officer in determining whether it is the interest of justice to release a child. And these factors that should be taken into account include factors like whether the child has a previous conviction, the best interest of the child, the seriousness of the offense. When releasing a child, the presiding officer may also impose conditions. The presiding officer must direct the parent or an appropriate adult to appear in court and warn the parent or the appropriate adult to ensure that the child appears in court. If the child fails to appear or to comply with any condition that may have been imposed by a presiding officer, the presiding officer may issue a warrant of arrest or summon the child to appear in court. The court will then inquire as to the reason why the child failed to appear and take appropriate steps which are set out in the clause itself. The bill relies almost entirely on the provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act regarding the release on bail. The release on bail must be considered in three stages. The first stage is to consider whether the interest of justice, it is in the interest of justice to release the child on bail. And then at the second stage, it involves an inquiry into the child's or the parent's ability to pay the amount or the money that's set for bail.
if the child or the parent or the appropriate adult is unable to pay, the presiding officer must set other conditions which does not include the payment of an amount and then release the child on bail. Then looking at placement, Clause 26 sets out an approach to be followed when considering the placement of a child who is to remain in detention.
Then before you go to that part two, now you've an instance where this child is arrested and on your own assessment discover that they find that quota can be released to come and appear on the date specified by the court. Now, because as one of the was saying, most of these perpetrators are from in this periphery, the rural areas in Namibia, where you don't have street names, you don't have addresses and whatever. And in the case where, as Honorable Ntuli was saying, the parents would deliberately disown this child and said, no, we do not hear a thing about this child. And yes, it was a case of that. In those instances, what would happen? There was the possibility that they would release this child. He might not come back to contact him. That was the end of it. What happened to the I see before you respond to the other hand, Dr. Daniel, then I'll go
with it. Yes, and I apologize if I said something which is like slightly back to Clause C of Section, or rather of the Section 12. It concerns the matter of detention of a child after arrest or any offense. When the police officer, a police official is uncertain about the age, then that police official must get the opinion of a probation officer or a medical practitioner. Now, what is the position? Is there any provision, the way in which such a police official must treat the child in the period? Say, for instance, Jeff, but there may be a day or two which can be sign factor for that child. Now that police official, he has no opinion, or he has a fair opinion, but his opinion differs from that of his person taking detention. Now we must wait for the probation officer or a medical practitioner to express an opinion. Is there any provision now in the case of uncertainty? The police must handle a case like that. The child may be appear older than he is or younger than he is. And a lot of damage can be done if the doctor is not properly treated. Is there any provision our police officer or official must treat such a person in such a child? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Van Hansen, Honorable President.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's also my apology of coming late. Chairperson, there's only one aspect. I follow quite honestly what the bill intended to do. But here we speak of a child. Now, if you come on note 24, sub 2b, if the child is alleged to have committed an offense, referred to Schedule 1, or two. Or the child, then the deciding officer can then release the child on his own recognition. Now, to me, we speak of a child. If you say, you can go and come back tomorrow, how often can that child come? And it also says that the warrant of arrest would be issued. What responsibility has that child to answer to those that you have been now released on your own recognition, and now you've been arrested? A child is a child. I don't know what age we
what we are referring to here. But if you speak of a child, you cannot release a child on its own recognition. I would like to get any clarity on that one. Thank you.
Yeah, I took a child from 10 years to 14 years. And you must, and the child must be warned and told of his rights or her rights. The 11-year-old, 10-year-old must be told, you are come back and some of the laws are passing really right. Okay, those are the questions from my colleagues. Who wants to start first in responding? And that's it.
I'll start with the question regarding Section 12. I think that's exactly what Section 12 tries to cover, that where a police official is uncertain as to the age of the child, the police official must treat the child in accordance with the act until, in accordance with what is provided in that particular clause, until there is an opinion by the probation officer or a medical practitioner. So where the police officer believes that the child is under the age of 10, is uncertain, but believes that the child is under the age of 10 years, the police officer must treat the child as a child under the age of 10 years, which means the police officer cannot arrest the child, but must deal with the child in terms of Section 9. And where the police believe that the child is 10 years or older but under the age of 14 must deal with the child in terms of the provisions of the Act until that is, or if the police gets an opinion from the probation officer or a medical practice.
Okay, platforms, we must respond to my questions. Question was Dr.
On the question, you know, what happens if the child does, if the parent isn't there, I think that's dealt with in clause 22. A police official only really has quite limited discretion relating to release compared to the discretion that a court has relating to release of a child. So a police official can release a child that's committed a Schedule 1 offence if the child into the care of a parent or appropriate adult, unless, and it says, the child's parent or an appropriate adult cannot be vacated or is not available and all reasonable efforts have been made to vacate the parent, or there's a substantial risk that the child may be a danger to any other person, to any other person or to the child himself or herself. So where these circumstances aren't present, then the police official really has no option, I think, but to keep the child in detention in a police cell for the first 48 hours, and then the court takes over and will make a decision regarding the release. So for a Schedule 1 offence, the police official must release the child unless, as I said, the child's parents or adult cannot be vacated. What clause 22 also does, and this is what I referred to just now, Chair, legislation can only go so far, and what we're trying to attempt here is that children are released where at all possible. And in clause 22, sub clause 2 says where a policeman does not release a child, he must come, when he brings that child to court, he must hand in a report stating why the child was not released. So there's, again, it's an attempt to make sure that what we're trying to achieve as far as
acknowledging that some of our children don't have identity documents, because usually it's gleaned during the assessment process when the child has documentation to give validity to the age. And where there isn't, we've inferred in section 90, in the situation when you've come to court and you can't determine your age, or we would have then put in some sort of process that we would now also, whatever, send a note to the Department of Home Affairs to ensure that that child is registered. And if there isn't a provision, or whatever the outcome of that is, we then come back to report to court, so that as we find children who come through the system who would not have had the necessary identity documents, even though that number is now decreasing, that there would be this measure to catch those children and ensure that we have some sort of arrangement with the DHA to then ensure that that child is registered.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to add to what my colleagues have said. After or during assessment, the probation officer also tries to estimate the age and also make sure that they locate the parent. If they fail, they also identify a suitable person. And I think the bill is also, under the definition, they try to define what is suitable person, a person in a community that is having a special relationship with that child, so that at least the child can await trial there rather than going to a police cell or a prison. But if all fail, then a police official must opt for the child in youth care center so that the child can be seen.
Or an appropriate other. There's a new term today, it was just then. In your definition, you see this appropriate other. We're trying to find out what is the. But the explain, but we said we'll come back. It's very interesting. Very well. Yeah. I think, yes, that's about it.
Yeah, actually, I think we responded to Mr. Mzizi's question on clause 24. I think the concern was raised there about a child being released on his or her own recognizance. Clause 24 is sort of based on section 72 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which allows a court to release a child for any offence on letter on warning. What clause 24 does says almost the same thing. It says a child is in detention in respect of any offence. Presiding officer can consider the release of the child. But and then it goes on to say the presiding officer may release such a child into the care of a parent or an appropriate adult, that's for any offence, but for a Schedule 1 or 2 offence, the court can release that child on his or her own recognizance. But for both those categories, for any offence or Schedule 1 or 2 offence on the child's own recognizance, it must be in the interest of justice. So the court has a discretion. Why we've limited release on own recognizance to Schedule 1 or 2 offences, because they are very serious offences, they're not as serious as a Schedule 3 offences, and a child cannot be released on own recognizance for a Schedule 3 offence. But the court must be satisfied that it's in the interest of justice to do so. And I'd like to think that our courts, when releasing a child on their
said one, he said they're not serious, but those are serious, the other said, am I reading the opposite? Am I reading for it?
Serious.
This is serious. Yeah, I'm looking at those speciality there, you know, speciality. That is brutality to animals. You regard that as at least, now we'll come to that, but now I want to put it to this and advise my colleague. So that what can you do with some of these offenses and such as one? Have they responded to your questions, sir, colleagues? So that allows us another lecture to come to us in another 5 minutes or so. First, is there anything?
Thank you, Chair. I noticed there was a concern in the portfolio committee as well about the transportation of children with adults. I would just like to understand when would it be necessary to transport children with adults, and if that happens, then what are the precautions in practical terms that would be taken to protect those children? Thank you.
Yeah, that's Patricia. Our session. That the way where she recites, she knows exactly what to do. Yeah, can you respond to that?
Yeah, sorry. Can we park this for South African Police Services, if you don't mind? Because we had a lot of deliberation on that, and I think it's most appropriate for them to respond to this point.
I agree with Shireen. I can perhaps just give you some of the an example why, you know, why it's often so difficult for police to transport adults separately from children, although that is what should be happening. You take, for instance, the Northern Cape. The distances a child has to be transported every 14 days from, I'm not too sure the places there, but hundreds of kilometres, and an adult also has to be transported. Is that perhaps only one vehicle? How does one deal with it? That's just by way of example, the difficulties in practice that one can come across. The ideal is, and this is what the provision is trying to say, where a child is transported to or from a preliminary inquiry of child justice court, the child must be transported separately from adults, provided that where it's not possible to comply, the police official must, within 48 hours, submit a prescribed written report to the presiding officer furnishing reasons for non-compliance. So again, they'll be setting out what the idea is that should be followed as far as is possible, but also trying to put a mechanism in place where it is in exceptional circumstances not just simply not possible that the court must be furnished with a report by the police official saying telling explaining the circumstances why it was not possible.
Yeah, transported from the Arch to Abington, or from Abington to Kimber, where you drive the distances that are, you travel the whole day, you know. Honorable Founder Member?
Mr. G, yeah, Abington is not far, it comes from Springbok, over 800 kilometers from Kimberley. But I believe it's some registered courses going to open up in that area that might be more helpful in the future.
Yes, yes, respond to that.
I just wanted to say what we have considered between the departments is looking at not necessarily, especially when it comes to a preliminary inquiry, which will be held at a court, looking at where the secure care, because at the moment we have 32 secure care facilities, 31 secure care facilities, with a possible 20 more designated. I stand corrected by my colleagues from social development because it's their competency. If you look at the bill, I think in section 90 where we have these one-stop centres, we're looking at making it more efficient instead of the transportation where we can minimise it. Wherever there's a secure care facility where children may be detained, try and have the preliminary inquiry located within the secure care facility so it might prevent, because previously, with the way we allocated provided these services differently. The idea now is to be as integrative as possible, and the proposed one-stop centers in this book is one example. But over and above that, what we have already begun considering as different departments is where we have a secure care facility, we can always proclaim a seat of court in a secure care facility. So it minimizes further traveling, but also the expenses, and it's less trauma for children. And eradicates or minimizes as much of the current challenges that we have. And that is why you will see that section crafted in a way that says we may designate these. So we're trying to see how we can best do this at the moment. And similarly, we're looking at also from a sentencing perspective to try and accommodate children in secure care facilities, taking into account the different prescripts that are required for sentenced children and children who may be awaiting trial. So they're separate, but we can be as effective and as productive in the usage of our resources. I don't think that answers you directly, but that's some of the challenges that we've seen in the system, and we will, when we then present our report once this bill is passed, I'm sure you'd want to then challenge us to say, did we put this or haven't we put? But I assure you, we, especially at our level, have gone around looking at different facilities to see how we can best do this.
Standard is Clause 26, placement continues.
Clause 26 sets out an approach to be followed when considering the placement of a child who is to remain in detention. A presiding officer, a police officer, have to make a decision regarding the placement and are obliged to give preference to the least restrictive option possible. Choices of placement for police officials in the first 48 hours before the child appears in court. In the case of any offence, if the child is between the ages of 10 and 14, detention must be in a child and youth care center unless this option is not available. In the case of a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 offense, where the child is 14 years or older, detention must be in the youth and care center unless this option is not also not available. In case of a Schedule 3 offense, where the child is 14 years or older, or where the child and youth care center is not an option, due to the unavailability, then detention must be in the police cell or in the police cell. Clause 28 provides for the protection of children detained in police custody. A child must be detained separately from adults, and boys must be separate from girls. Children must be treated in a manner consistent with their needs, which includes the provision of appropriate health care, adequate food, water, and bedding, to mention a few. If a child complains of physical injury or appears to be in pain or is suffering from severe trauma, this must be reported by the police official to the station commissioner, who must in turn ensure that the child receives appropriate medical care, medical treatment, and that the report is submitted to the national commissioner. Each police station is required to record the details of a child in detention in a police cell or lockup in a manner that is clearly distinguishable from that of the adult. Choices of placement after the first or during the first appearance. In case of any offense, detention can be in a child and youth care center.
So, I just want to find out that whether the relevant people that I'm going to ask this question, that the station commissioner of each police station must keep a register. It's the question that I must ask the police. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Dealing with the choices of placement in court after the first appearance. In case of any offense, detention can be in a child and youth care center. However, Section 29 sets out factors to be taken to be considered when considering placement in a child and youth care center. The factors include the maturity of the child, the seriousness of the offense, the availability of accommodation in the child and youth care center, and the appropriateness of the level of security at the child and youth care center. Placement in prison may only be ordered if the child is accused of having committed an offense referred to in Schedule 3. And the child must be 14 years or older.
Maybe for now, let's stop there. I'm sorry to stop you unceremoniously. We'll start with clause 30 when we come back from lunch. But let me check with the colleagues if they are questions. For now, for the sources that just through. Maybe let me start with that clause 38. Let me read the a child who, okay, protection of children is detained in police custody. Then it's one. Child who is detention for this custody must, I'm now taking it to see, must be permitted to visit by parents, I'm on the very last sentence. And any person, or in terms of the law, is entitled to visit. Any person. Yeah, I want us to look into this, maybe when we come back, because there are parents, there are people who might pretend to be a relative of this particular child. While the purpose of visiting is not just when he's looking for moral support or whatever, but to do something else. You know of incidents that happened for example, they were going to a hospital. You know what happened in many hospitals, where they go and kill someone who is under police guard. Now, this one, when it says any person who is in terms of the law, is entitled to visit. I wonder how can we coin this and make sure that we don't open it there, because you might allow other people to visit who are not supposed to visit. And to cause serious whatever to the point child. I'm talking about this through experience. I know of some of the incidents that are very horrible. I don't know. Maybe when we come back. But before we adjourn, I'll take you there are questions to colleagues. I want to give this. How many questions are here? One. I want NPA to respond to this as well. Anyway, I want to ask a question. I want you to respond to this question before I can. In your opinion, why our kids are committing the violent crime? Why? Our prisons are full of young people who committed serious crime. In all investigations, what are the reasons why our kids are committing the serious crime? I want self development to start first. Just calling you can start first. Followed by Sherif, then Lawrence, and that's where we come. NPA will be the last one to respond. In all investigation, why are our kids committing this serious violent crime? Why?
Thank you, Chair. I think from our assessment of social development, there are various factors that we have established. For instance, the issue of family disintegration and the issue of family lack of parental care and supervision. Because you find a lot of children abusing substances. And as they abuse substances, they also engage in violent crimes, in gangs.
terrorism and so on. But other categories of children, they are also, I can call them victims of poverty. You find that that is why the type of crimes that they commit is also economic. So the issue of child-headed household also contributes, because they strive for survival, and as they do that, they engage in various unlawful activities, you can say that, because the support they've got is not really 24 hours, and sometimes you find that a 15-year-old is the eldest who assume a responsibility of trying to supervise the other siblings. And in that case, you find that that child engages in alcohol. I've read also in the paper that you find that the child also sells her body in order to get 5 rand or 10 rand to support the siblings. So those are the issues that come through as we do assessment and from the observations.
That's a good answer.
Chair, I think one has to be also very clear in that whatever we have made from our own assessment, there has been state commissioned research at this stage, which is conclusive. We've pulled from different types of research that have been conducted both locally and internationally, looking at the causes of crime. And I think, you know, it's a debatable point on many levels as to why certain people commit certain types of offences. Part of what we have looked at from a vulnerable category perspective is, my colleague has already pointed out, poverty, lack of employment, educational opportunity, or lack of opportunity. We also have a high number of children that are dropping out of school for a number of reasons. Looking at drugs and alcoholism, which has already been pointed out, having regard to the fact that you don't always have positive role models in your life, and usually what we've noticed is a high increase of, let alone child-headed households, single-parent households. And if they even consider that more of our boys are in the system than girls, looking at that phenomena of a father figure, but also now we're finding that girl children are especially marginalized, and different types of phenomena are affecting them. And I think we're going to see different trends coming out in the next few years. We've also found an increase now of children that are used by adults to commit crime. If you look at some of our communities, I mean, just outside here, Elkins River, Bishop Labour, areas where socioeconomic rights are, income levels are rather low, but also the gang-infested environment. Even just outside Clifford, it's another example. I'm just leaving the areas around us, but then you also got other types of phenomena in our different environments. All child-headed households, the number of children who are orphans and going out to foster care, the kind of support that they're getting has been on the increase. Looking at some of the international studies, and there was a comparison done by one of the research institutions of countries that have had the kind of violent response to issues. And we can't firstly ignore the fact that our system has been traumatized all of us. The party system has traumatized a lot of us. If you look back in the 1990s, when the phenomena of child justice began in the 1992, I remember myself being a junior researcher at the time, the numbers of children in the Katoris, we used to call it at that time, Katoris area, was very high, children in detention. A lot of them came from the SDUs, and the SDUs that we called them at the time, the self-defense and self-protection units. And most of them were in for armed robbery or armed violence because they had access to arms, but then they got manifested for a different objective at the time in the criminal justice system. It was a way of keeping these children, you know, managing them from the SAP services at the time, and so they would then be detained. What would then happen is they would then get demeaned by the criminal justice system, and then they would then end up into a cycle of criminal violence, as it were. Also, we found, if you just look at some of the countries, Brazil, Colombia, El Salvador, Honduras, where there's a great sense of organized youth types of arrangements, youth gangs, and violent youth gangs, Nigeria to some extent, and the U.S., where you've got these institutionalized systems of how you behave across from people, and I think Connie raised the point of seeing of the newspaper. I saw that you can't actually, if you read some areas, you can't talk to each other. I think that's in Kenya that has manifested itself. But even though you grew up together and you're coming from the same, from different tribal groups, but you grew up together, the violence has got to such an extent that two children who would have been from different tribal groups and language speaking groups are not allowed to be friends anymore, even though they would have grown up with each other. When there's different types of violence going on, they would give different types of signals because they wanted to keep that kinship was still there. So, and also the way the state then responds to issues. So we still see in our media sometimes the way the state responds to certain types of issues, and on children as well. When the state responds in a violent manner, using arms, then the response again is the image that is left in children's minds, young people's minds. So where there's a higher rate of violence in the way the state is being intervened, you're also getting a higher rate of violent conflict back from the children. We found, if you just look at statistics from a few years ago, the hijacking, car hijackings were very violent. And a lot of it was children also having access to arms. And you know, being a gun-free society has a huge impact on us. So children having access to arms, not knowing how to manage them, also watching violent movies, even though one takes away now the other account of socioeconomic circumstances, you then respond to just managing any type of situation in a violent manner because that becomes the normal pattern, almost normalized. So we've got to respond in different ways from a prevention aspect as to some of the causes of crime. This is just some of the studies, as I say, it hasn't been state commissioned, but when we glean what are the causes, you're getting a range of factors that affect us.
Good.
Thank you.